everybody, and welcome to our October Care Partner Meetup. I'm Polly Dawkins, the Executive Director of the Davis Finney Foundation, and I am based here in Colorado, gorgeous Colorado right now. And I'm joined by some terrific panelists, and ready to turn it over to you, Connie.
Thank you, Polly. It's nice to be here. Gail, thanks again for stepping up, showing up, and doing all you do to mentor other care partners.
You're welcome.
Been with us before, you know that Gail lost her husband, Gene.
Almost 4 years ago.
4 years ago. I was going to say three, and that's just amazing. And it's amazing how much you've given back.
November 1st is 4 years. Amazing.
November 1st, yeah. Yeah, thank you for being here, Gail, and
sharing
your expertise and helping so many as a mentor in this space to navigate difficult times with our person with Parkinson's. Pat, of course, from dialing in from a classroom in Las Vegas, and we appreciate you taking the hour of power with us, Pat, and hope Sid is doing well. I think he'll let us know how things are going. And he's got to be on mute most of the time because he's got announcements in the background.
She's doing a lot better. I mean, she's doing great. She's going in next week for some knee surgery. And as a result of all of her dyskinesia, she's going to get repaired in her knee. And we're excited for that. So things are on the up and up.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a positive thing, I think, probably when you're looking forward and trying to be more, get out there and be more able to move. That's awesome. I love hearing that. And our special guests today are from Austin, Texas. We, for the first time, have a person with Parkinson's joining us on the Care Partner Meetup. And it's really awesome to have Alan Cole joining us together with his care partner, Tracy Cole. And, you know, I'm going to let you guys maybe introduce yourselves a little bit. But part of what intrigued me about Alan is not only the work that he does, he's also, you know, a terrific advocate for people with Parkinson's and very honest about talking about his story and his experiences with Parkinson's, but also helping others. And I think that maybe comes from your background as a social worker. But also, I think just, you know, not everybody's in that situation, right? I know my husband's a coach, and that's really why he started the Davis Finney Foundation, is so he could help coach others through these this difficult and challenging disease. But I really appreciate it and would love to hear a little bit more from you about your background. What brings you, you know, to this capacity to share? And also, Tracy, a lot more about you.
You want to start?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Hello, everyone. I'm Tracy Cole, and married to this lovely human, Alan, for 32 years plus. We have two girls, 18 and 16. Alan and I have really figured out a way to sort of rely on one another with this illness as the patient and caregiver. And we have a terrific support system. And really feel our lives in a very strange way. Our lives are so much more enriched by having the illness. Alan knew that there was something wrong with him before he was diagnosed, but for 8 years now, our lives, our life together is incredibly full with all the people that we have around us, and also by helping the people with Parkinson's that have come into our lives. I was a social worker, worked with geriatric patients in medical settings, and I ran support groups, ironically, for caregivers for those with dementia. and some of the dementia was related to Parkinson's patients. That seems like a lifetime ago because we had our children, and I stepped away from social work for a little bit. I have a baking business, which brings me great joy, but I have a yearning to go back to social work. So maybe that's in the not too distant future.
Thank you for having us, by the way. Really delighted. We're looking forward to this conversation. So 26 of this month will be 8 years since I was diagnosed. I was diagnosed at 48 years old. And as Tracy was saying, it was, you know, in some ways one of the worst and one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I never would have believed that had it not been my experience. But I'm not ready to say I would sign up for Parkinson's, but it's really brought a lot of beautiful people and beautiful experiences to my life that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And so I've learned over those 8 years to hold those intention, right? It's both something you don't want and something that in some ways you're grateful for, at least what it's produced in your life, even if you wish it had come by other means. Connie, you're asking about my background. I come from, you know, social work and you know, mental health, and I'm an academic. I'm a dean of the School of Social Work at UT Austin. And so I've always been oriented toward community and trying to be a resource and allowing others to be a resource for me. And I think that has helped us, you know, Tracy's having a similar background, albeit a little bit delayed for me. I was in the closet for about the first 10 months. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, people are public when they need to be public, but I probably needed to be public before I was. It was awfully hard to hold that diagnosis as long as I did. But once I did, it just became, for me, how do I try to do something good with something I wish I didn't have? And how can something that's not good be used for good in the world and with people I care about? And so that's sort of what orients me. And that's taken different forms. I ask myself what I could do. I can write and I can teach. I'm an educator, and just try to use those platforms to you know, spread awareness and to engage in advocacy and to support people.
Yeah, thank you. And let's go ahead and put up the website address for PDWise, because there's a lot of resources on there if you haven't already been exposed to Alan's website. It's got a lot of essays and links to his books and you know, other stories that I think that you'll enjoy, because I think for a lot of us, you know, a lot of what we learn outside of the doctor's office is in first person stories and in our capacity to connect with one another. And certainly we need people like Tracy and Alan to be able to speak up and talk about, you know, the challenges and kind of help us navigate. So we appreciate you being leaders in that space. And you know, I wonder what's the hardest thing for you to, with your both having a social work background, that do you overanalyze the situation, or do you come at it with different tools? You know, how do you separate, or how does it integrate to work so well? Because it seems like it's working.
Yin and yang. It's as simple as that.
Oh, interesting.
We complement one another. Yeah, I think it's fair to say we complement one another. And I think we know more. I think we know more than we actually act on at all times, right? I mean, we know sort of what can be most helpful, but that doesn't mean we always do it, right? I mean, we're just like everybody else. But I think both of us have a capacity to listen and to have empathy and, you know, to sort of give each other the benefit of the doubt. And we don't get it done perfectly every time, but I think that's served us well. That's at the core of social work, you know, trying to be present for other people where they are, not necessarily where you want them to be. And I find those skills and that training helpful when I'm meeting people, particularly who are just getting on the Parkinson's road themselves and just need sort of a space to be held in and sort of, you know, be recognized and to be or say or do whatever they need to do to sort of take that next step.
Yeah. But what I'm wondering too, and, you know, Tracy, you'll have to answer this one maybe, is whether or not, does he listen to you with your challenges as well?
Absolutely. I think in spite of the challenges, I think what's really key is to be present for each other. You know, I don't know. I can't imagine what the symptoms are like to experience dyskinesia. And so I'm just an active listener. But I do think that you asked something earlier, you mentioned something earlier about the issue of like overreacting, or it's sort of the yin and the yang, where he can just have his, you know, share his emotions. And for me, just to be present, even if I think I know something, I will delay in responding, because it's, there are so many losses involved with this disease that I just, you know, it's grief, and like any loss, just to be an active listener is really important. And then I wait till the time is right to offer my feedback, suggestions. I think it's really easy for people, couples, family members to get very reactionary when you see your family member in distress. And, you know, I think just to kind of be calm is important. And we also use humor. I mean, that is in some of the lowest times that we've had with Parkinson's, somehow we find a way to just laugh about. I mean, I find ourselves laughing a lot about the really hard stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. We laugh at some of the things that happen without. Having Parkinson's isn't funny, but funny things can happen by virtue of, you know, living with this illness that, you know, you wouldn't experience otherwise. And so we try to, levity is important for our family. It was before Parkinson's, and that's just who we are. And I think it's been helpful. I want to say this, Connie, it's really important. You know, in those days and weeks after I was diagnosed, Tracy was the one who knew I was going to be okay. I didn't know that. And she held, you know, me in that space until I could get there myself. And I really give her a lot of credit. She'd worked around Parkinson's a lot and, you know, her social work. And she gave me the gift of sort of getting where I needed to get when I needed to get there. And that's really important for people to hear, I think. It's, you know, it's not a one size fits all, but for us, she believed I was going to be okay and knew it in her heart before I could even give that a chance. You know, I didn't know much about Parkinson's. I didn't, you know, I assumed that my life was over, and, you know, all the things that are kind of, you know, characteristic of people who are naive. But she knew a lot more than I did, and she helped me get up to speed. And I told people she believed for us, and, you know, until I could believe it myself.
Let's lean into that for a second from Tracy. So Tracy, how did you know he was going to be okay? How did you know that?
I knew that, you know, Parkinson's was a progressive, you know, a chronic progressive disease. And I knew that people mostly did not die from Parkinson's disease, that it just, they would most likely die with Parkinson's disease. I also just did research with the diagnosis about young onset. And, you know, we met with the diagnosing neurologist early on, and he really affirmed what I had learned about young onset Parkinson's, that typically progresses slowly, and the symptoms aren't as intense. But I also know Alan's character, and I know that he's a fighter, and I believe that even in our darkest days after the initial diagnosis, that we would be okay together. And our children too. I mean, you know, we didn't share the news with them for a long time, but we just knew that they would be able to handle it, just because of we're a close-knit family.
They were 10 and 8 when I was diagnosed, so.
Right. Yeah, very similar to my kids. But how were you able to keep it from them if you made it public at work?
Yeah, well, I wasn't public. As soon as I went public, I told them before I went public.
Okay. You
know, I mean, other than Tracy, we had a couple of close friends who knew, and then my doctors, and nobody else knew. You know, I was terrified. I thought, I'm in the prime of my career. I'm going to lose you know, credibility, you know, all the things that go through your head. People are going to think I can't do my job. How am I going to send my kids to college? All that. But so for about 10 months, I was silent. But then, you know, I had the two hardest conversations I ever had were with my parents and with my kids. And I did that, you know, in a couple of days before I went public at work and everything else. But they were young, and, you know, we wanted to make sure they heard it from me, and we didn't share it with anybody before we shared it with them.
Yeah, I think we get a lot of questions on here. There are cases, and it's not that frequent because it is a disease that's a little bit hard to hide.
Eventually.
So, you know, some people do try to hide it though, and I think that they're afraid of there's a lot of things. You know, one is all the questions that you get from people, and of course, another is whether when you're young, especially if you're gonna suffer, you know, be left behind because, you know, if you're up for a promotion, might go to someone else. But, you know, the majority of our listeners are actually older as well, and a lot are retired. And one of the sensations they have, and I don't know if you can put yourself into these shoes, and I know we've got a conversation going in the chat that we need to get to, but there's this kind of feeling too, I think, among care partners when their person is diagnosed that, you know, maybe they're close to retirement or they're just retired and this happens. And, you know, it's a different kind of devastation, right? It's a different kind of turmoil that comes into the relationship. And I wonder if you have experience or thoughts about that.
Well, for me, I think, you know, we experienced the disease where we are, right? And so for me, it was a kind of a midlife. And so, I mean, it meant in my mind, I had to redefine my dreams and, you know, things that I thought I'd do, maybe I wouldn't. Which turns out, by the way, that's not necessarily true. But I mean, these are the things I thought of in the beginning. And I think wherever one gets on the road and however they get on it publicly, is really on their own terms, right? Because I know people who've, you know, been private about it for years. I know people who've, you know, been public about it immediately and everything in between. For me, I wish I'd been public about it sooner because I carried a secret, and the secret started doing more damage to me than I envisioned being public about Parkinson's would ever do. And, you know, but for me, it became a question of, you know, could I teach the students the things I was teaching them about authenticity and being, you know, forthright about one's status and not do that, not model that, right? And with my kids too. And so for me, it became a matter of conscience. And then I started thinking, look, I have an opportunity here to try to do something that contributes, and that was important to me to make meaning and to, you know, find value in something again that I wish I didn't have. But yeah, I think that's the one thing I want to emphasize. It's never a one size fits all. It's not a one size fits all disease, and the way we respond is, you know, as different as we are.
Yeah, the challenges are different, and some move much more swiftly than others, and it's challenging, and everybody has a different response, I think, with the depending on where you're coming from. Polly, can you share, where should we start in the chat? I know there's
Yeah,
been some.
we've got a couple of questions from care partners. The first is from somebody named Terry, and she asks, or they ask, I don't know, how to break through the resistance of a person with Parkinson's who refuses to seek help other than medication. So, such as physical therapy, counseling, or support groups. Do y'all have thoughts
Can
on
we
that?
ask how old the person is? Terry, could you give us some sense of the age?
This
Waiting.
was somebody who wrote in before ahead of time,
Oh,
so I don't know if they're on right now.
I think if it's possible to understand first and foremost why they are resistant, to get to that. And I think maybe if the individual, the caregiver, can maybe work with someone in a faith community or someone counseling, there may be support groups for caregivers who can maybe get some ideas from other people who are serving as caregivers how to break through. I think that's really hard if you're if the person is experiencing so much resistance, but to understand really why they don't want to get the help. If it's they're embarrassed.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to, yeah, it's really fair to say that Parkinson's is a disease of management. Right. And if you fail to manage it, not only will it be harder on the person with Parkinson's, but it'll be much harder on the care partner. Right. And I saw that somebody just put in the chat that their husband of 79 years of age feels like that's maybe his last powers is be able to say no. And it is a bit like a toddler, right? Just sticking, you know, sticking your heels in and saying, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to do it. And this must be an incredible source of frustration. But I think that that's a good point, is that the care partner then has to recruit someone else. I think you're really right about that, Tracy, that it can't always be us. And we get that question a lot too, is do I always have to be a nag? Right. You know, you know, for the person that, you know, apathy is a big part of this disease, and it doesn't affect everyone. And if it does affect your person with Parkinson's, they will be less likely to accept help or to seek other modalities of help, which could be extremely beneficial to them. And so I think trying to recruit someone else and really communicating with the doctor's office, that's another point I think that needs to be clear, because they're used to this. They know what the, you know, there's a lot of different archetypes for Parkinson's. There's not just one. And it's not just people that are well managed. It's people that aren't. And so if your person is not cooperating, the doctors need to know that. It could be something that's could be mediated medication wise, or at least, you know, prompted them. I don't know, Pat or Gail, do you guys have some thoughts on that? Or Gail, you're muted.
We can't.
Well, I didn't have the apathy problem so much, but in order to make things that were good for him fun, I participated. You know, I went boxing with him. I went to ping pong with him. I went to spinning classes with him. And then we went out for his favorite coffee drink afterwards, and it became a date. And this is what we did on those days. And there was just no question.
Yeah, you were able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, in 2011, Sydney came home and said, I'm going to ride my bike across Iowa. And that began a, you know, since 2011, it's 2024 now, that's began a long career of lots. In fact, we just signed up for Tour to Tucson last night. I'll be riding it. She won't, but she's going to anyway. So we're just, you know, the apathy, it's there, and it's a continual bugger that shows up on occasion. And getting involved and listening and not make any rash discussions or anything that pulls them down, pulls her down, what have you. It's important to do that. And I'm not always the best at it, but I try hard.
And again, apathy is, you know, treatable.
Right.
In a lot of cases, and but not really by the care partner. That's the hard part, right? I mean, that's the experience I've learned or heard about through others, and this is where having a team is so important, and having the right doctors and friends and family members. You know, Alan and Tracy, you guys have young kids. My kids are now in their 30 and 34. And I find them to be terrifically helpful, especially to me. They really call me out on my behavior sometimes if I'm either doing too much or, you know, maybe being a little too harsh. I hear about it, and you know, it's good to have other people on your team that will be honest with you.
Yeah, our kids at 18 and 16 call me out all the time, so I can relate to that about Parkinson's and many other things. One of the things I was going to say, though, just before we turn the page on this, I have experienced that there are people who would never go to a support group, but they'll go to boxing or they'll go get a cup of coffee with somebody. You know, you don't, it's kind of indirect support, right? We're just going to hang out and, you know, or do something they enjoy, you know, But being with people, right? Because it's such an it can be such an isolating experience for the caregiver or the care partner and the person with Parkinson's. Sometimes it's not the support group, although I'm all for support groups. I've led many of them over the years. But sometimes it's just a friend, to be out with and maybe talk about Parkinson's, maybe you don't. And for me, I always tell people there's a lot of blending, but I have groups of friends who are, totally part of the Parkinson's community. And I have friends who have absolutely nothing to do with Parkinson's other than they know me. And for me, it's important to have a sort of range of relationships so that it's not always about Parkinson's, but it need whenever I, it's appropriate to be or I need it to be, I have people with whom I can have those experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Polly, where should we go with the
Yeah,
question?
we have another question from Victoria who asks, do you care partners speak with your person with Parkinson's doctor, their neurologist, without their knowledge?
You can't do that without having the HIPAA release form. So that's the privacy release forms. These are important conversations to have, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, and it's easy to sort of get lost in the system if you don't hit that head on, and if your person doesn't agree. Your person with Parkinson's has to agree to let your doctors talk to you. And most movement disorder doctors that I know consider the person's the care partner to be an integral part of the team and would prefer to see you both together than just the person with Parkinson's. And we've advocated for that. We've advocated for you to go to the doctor appointments, for you to get to know whether it's the nurse practitioner or the PA or the specialist, and for you to record those conversations rather than trying to take notes because those visits are always too short and they're too important. If your person is resistant to that, I'm not sure you can work around it. And so I think you want to try to get those permissions soon, and the doctors can help you explain that to your person too, why it's beneficial, and especially where side effects of medicines are concerned, because you're the one reporting that. You need to report, and you can report that to your doctor's office without your person's permission, but they will not release information to you without that. Gail, do you have something to add to
Yes,
that?
a few things. First of all, it's really important to go with your person with Parkinson's. I think with the information that an individual is getting, it's very often not something I want to hear. So it's something that they don't retain, they don't listen, they can't focus. And it really takes two people. The other thing that you can do if you can't get to the physician is send an email to the office, to him, explaining what's really going on, not the only the stuff that he's getting from the person with Parkinson's, because they probably only give them half a story and bolster themselves up for the visit. So if you want to give the honest truth from your perspective, you can send them an email. They don't have to respond to you, but if they have that in their back pocket, it's easy. It'll be easier for them to cut through the BS and really get down to the issues of the problem.
Yeah, I have the HIPAA form filled out, signed, and I have the doctor's, the MDS's cell phone, and we text when needed.
Yeah, you're one of the lucky ones, though.
Yeah, I
We're not
know.
even on a texting basis with our movement disorder doctors.
He has a small child now, and a new baby, so I try to stay away. And fortunately, I don't need his support so much right now. So he's
And
a
what
good.
about you, Alan and Tracy? Tracy, do you go to the appointments with
Yes,
Alan?
and we're very fortunate because Alan's primary neurologist. I mean, she engages me. It's not as though she's just having a conversation with Alan. She really welcomes any of my observations, and I think that's really important in the practitioner that, the patient it is seeing, because there's just a wealth of information that a caregiver can provide.
Right.
And I like the idea, you know, what Gail was saying, you know, just emailing some information, not expecting a response, but it's really important to report everything.
Yeah.
And I also say, go ahead, Pat.
I was just going to say, Connie, you introduced us a while back to the Otter app that'll give you a transcript and record the conversations at your appointments. In fact, my Otter app is recording this conversation right now. I don't know how that's set up, but it did.
Yeah.
And I get a transcript of our whole meetup. But it's been very helpful inside the doctor's office when I need to.
And it's helpful because a lot of times, you know, especially with our cohort that's listening here, so many people don't know how to share the news with their, you know, friends or adult children. And if you read the transcript from a doctor appointment and can pick out some of the salient points, it can help you drive a conversation to let them know truly how your person is doing. Mm-hmm. And the ones that want the information can read it, and those that don't, you know, they don't have to, right? But you're sharing it, and you're also creating a bit of a chronology for yourself. And it's helpful to look back and see what was discussed, what you missed, and maybe, you know, what you need to follow up on. And there's a lot of people, and I know someone was saying they were being ghosted by their neurologist, and or the neurologist didn't want to speak with the care partner. And in that case, it's time for, you know what I'm going to say, I'm like a broken record, but a new doctor. And I know they're not that easy to find. I know it takes a long time to get into a new practice, but I know it's possible. And, you know, one of the biggest problems I've seen with movement disorder docs who are the specialty trained, you know, they've taken a fellowship after they've gotten their neurologist, you know, training to work better with this population of people, with your person with Parkinson's. They're hard to, you know, they're few and far between, unfortunately, for the numbers of people who have Parkinson's, but they are the specialists. And all too many of them are also academics and are teaching and doing research, which means their clinic load is less. And so it makes them harder to get into. Doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Get on the waiting list. It might take you a year, but, you know, Parkinson's isn't cancer. It's not a pressing, you know, situation. It's not time sensitive. Of course it is if you've got something going on that needs management, but get yourself on some lists and see if it, you know, if it could change your life, because if your person is better managed, you're going to be a lot happier.
Elizabeth asks,
I have something. One thing I've done even before there was apps and all that other stuff is I have one notebook, and that notebook goes with us every single time we go to the doctor. So I can take notes, I can staple things to it, but that notebook, whatever scribbles, whatever, anything having to do with the disease goes into that notebook. It doesn't even have to be chronological, but it's there forever. And just take it with you. Just have all the meds listed, because sometimes to go over that again and again, or even have extra copies. So when they say, what are the meds they're on? Well, here, keep this, put in the file. But that's what I always had. And I had that notebook. I refer to that notebook constantly because of, and the name of every single doctor, every single phone number, every single address, every secretary that I made appointments with went into that notebook. Not little pieces of paper scattered all over the place. And that's
That's smart, Gail. That's a great tip to keep one dedicated notebook for all of your Parkinson's specific information. That is a great tip. And I hope people are doing that.
Yes, say one more thing real quickly.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
This is out of our experience, but I think it bears mentioning. I think there are people who don't know well how to allow other people to care for them. And sometimes they have Parkinson's. And so I just want to name that, because sometimes it's because of socialization. Sometimes it's because of personality or familial experience. Maybe it's all of the above. But sometimes those of us with an illness need to learn how to let other people care for us in ways that we're not accustomed to. And so I want to name that. And maybe that's part.
And do you have a tip for how to do that? Because it is really hard for people. That's a great tip.
Yeah, well, I think experience helps. You know, I mean, for me, I'll speak personally. you know, I'm oriented toward caring for other people, right? And so that's where my energy goes. But you know, Tracy's helped me understand that, you know, by my allowing others to care for me, I'm giving them something in return, just like they give me when they allow me to care for them, right? So it's as easy and as complicated as that. But sometimes we have to step out of roles that we're used to, you know, being in, or we just have to relearn the world in ways that, you know, Parkinson's or any other kind of hardship presents that we need to learn in order to navigate it well. So I just want to name that because I think it's...
Yeah, no, I think that's important. And has it been hard for you, Tracy, to also accept help?
No, but it was hard. Initially, it was hard for Alan. That's where his stubbornness came in. But no, I'm a giver and a taker. It's not a challenge for me. It's very easy for me to seek out, you know, emotional support. You know, it's just, I think it's just, it's an individual, it's innate a lot of the times.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is hard to learn that sometime, but we do need, you know, our person needs to know how to accept help and we need to be able to accept help. Polly, what have you got?
Yeah. So Elizabeth asks, in the doctor's appointment, are there any suggestions for when the doctor only wants to speak with or only directs the questions and the conversation to the care partner, even though the person with Parkinson's is fully capable of speaking?
Oh my goodness. I actually had this happen with Davis one time where it was a teaching situation and someone was looking and talking at me and the lead doctor was just really read the Residents Riot Act, you know, eyes over here on the patient. And it was, you know, it was super instructive and it was a little jarring too, but it was, it is important not to be excluded as the care partner, but definitely not to be the first line, right? Like the first line is to be looking at and querying the patient, the person with Parkinson's, unless it's a care partner question. But I don't know, Tracy and Alan, do you have some thoughts about that?
That hasn't been our experience, I think, with any of the practitioners that we've seen. But that's a really tricky situation. I think you just have to, you know, advocate if it's you know, the patient is being disregarded. You really need to bring that to the practitioner's attention. It's simply wrong.
You know, it's interesting because I recently was helping a friend of mine whose son is undergoing treatment for lymphoma, and he's only an 8-year-old child. And it was amazing to me to watch his father, who's a dear friend of mine, navigate all the questions that came at, usually do come to the parent, right? And he was saying, he was really making sure his son was hearing the questions and involved in the answers. And it was really instructive. And the clinicians in the practice were very adept at it too. I mean, it was a children's hospital. So I was really impressed with that. And I think that should be the model, right? That the care partners included and involved, and especially a parent, but also that they realize that it is a team and that they can help foster, you know, the team, which is the care partner and the person with Parkinson's, or, you know, who's ever the patient. I think it's important. And I think you have to insist on it. And if it doesn't happen organically and you can't get it to change, again, it's time to, you know, maybe look for another doctor in the practice or another physician. And it's not easy, but it is important. We've talked about that a lot here. Polly, what else?
Tracy and Alan, a question comes to you. Can you share what resources that you use individually or collectively for mental health emotional therapy?
Well, we're true supporters of therapy, our entire family. We're very open about mental health and you know, what it looks like when you are healthy, physically, emotionally, spiritually. You know, I've throughout my life, I've always seen a therapist, but we used to be a part of Power for Parkinson's, which is an exercise group in Austin, which also has information to share online. But, you know, there are other caregivers there that, you know, I can rely on. I also have a dear friend whose husband just coincidentally has Parkinson's disease. So, you know, if the disease progresses for Alan, and you know, I'm needing more support, I know there are resources out there that I would probably seek a support group. But at this time, you know, I have a lot of really good friends, and I have a therapist who happens to be a medical doctor. So she really understands Parkinson's. And you know, I have some friends who are familiar with Parkinson's disease, but one specifically whose husband is far along into the illness. And, you know, I can go to her for anything.
And she runs marathons too. That's good for her mental health.
Yeah. Well, that does help. I mean, any kind of movement for me, and baking. You know, those are two things that really bring me a lot of joy and revitalization.
Yeah, similarly for me, I mean, I have a therapist that I, you know, I talk to regularly and have for many years. I'm in that business, so I try to model for our students the value in that. And I have a lot of friends that, you know, many of whom are connected to Parkinson's, many of whom are not. I like to play music. I've learned how to play bass guitar at 55 years old. Best thing I've ever done in my life. And it's my world now. So I'm in a couple of bands, and, you know, that takes me to all kinds of places that are, you know, freeing of, you know, burdens that I might carry around otherwise. So yeah, I think for both of us, just sort of doing what we've always done, but also finding ways to, you know, incorporate the good parts of Parkinson's into our lives is good for our mental and our overall health.
And I want to add that one of the bands that he's in, the name of it is Movement Disorder.
Well, that's a little humor right there.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's a good band name, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. I don't know that many people would understand it, but I love, you know,
that
get the
joke, connection. Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. That's awesome. And you know, on that note, I see someone's asking for us to share what we do for humor. And I'm wondering who wants to jump in on that. That was a good starting point. Come on, Pat. What do you and Sid do to make yourselves laugh?
I'm stuck. Go ahead, Gail.
Sometimes the things are just so ridiculous that when you explain it to someone, you just have to laugh. You just have to laugh at you preparing and trying to get everything just right. And your person with Parkinson's finds a way around that you never experienced. And then you stand there and you wonder, what more can I have done? And, you know, if you're right in the right frame of mind with the right person, you know, you can just really laugh at some of the absurdities that occur.
Yeah, and I think one of the easiest ways to get each other laughing for Davis and me to kind of ward off the facial masking, which is such a typical part of Parkinson's, is to work on facial expressions in the mirror and just to make them as silly as possible and just to just be as goofy as we can be. And there is no way you don't crack up when you're making really funny faces in the mirror with each other. It's hysterical, yeah. Right?
Yeah, we're gonna practice that.
Yeah. But what about you, Alan and Tracy? You guys just like to keep it light, or do you have a go-to technique?
Well, part of it, I mean, for me, like, we have two daughters, and I like kind of telling the dad jokes and like semi-embarrassing them in front of their friends. Nothing, you know, over the top, but, you know, just kind of keeping them honest. I have fun with that, and they laugh about it. And so we a lot of our humor stems from there. But, you know, and everybody's different. But for me, so recently I've started experiencing some motor fluctuation, so I have some dyskinesia. And so I'll just say, you know, I'm a rocker, and you know that cracks my kids up. I'll say I'm just like, all I need is a bass in my hand, and I'll, you know, it's just like I'm playing a show. And so we just try to, you know, name it, make fun of it. You know, it's part of our lives. It's not the entirety of our lives. And for us, that works, you know, and their friends, you know, and like having a band named Movement Disorder, you know, that's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing that works for us.
Yeah, and I like somebody wrote Modern Family. I do believe that watching sitcoms, like, avoid the news. Just don't watch it. There's nothing. Forget about the election. Just put on some, you know, some Brooklyn Nine-Nine or some, you know, Modern Family or I Love Lucy, whatever, you know, floats your boat. But you got to do something to just kind of distract yourself and just, you know, just laugh and, you know, really, you know, regulate. You know, we used to say, as elite athletes, I was always put on what we call the media diet, which meant I couldn't read anything anybody wrote about me. It would be harder to do today. But you know, and the reason is because, you know, you're just trying to, you know, get through the day and not have other news bring you down. And so many of us are having the news on all the time and forcing ourselves into such a negative headspace. You know, you can't afford that as a care partner. And especially those of you who are really struggling with a person that's, you know, at a really critical junction, and, you know, perhaps in their experience with Parkinson's, and or maybe in your own life too, you've got enough going on, and then to top that off with watching the news, how is that going to help? You know, so you either have to turn the TV on, put some good music on, or turn the TV off, sorry, put some good music on, or you know, watch things that are lighter. I mean, I think it takes a lot of self-discipline in this world to not be sucked into the news trap, but I think it's important. What else we got, Polly? We've only got a few minutes.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes and some pretty big topics that might be hard to jump into. And maybe we'll save one of them for the next session.
Well, and if something's really kind of more pointed toward Alan and Tracy, let's go there.
Yeah, there is one that's a continuation about mental health support and counseling, which is what about grief and loss therapist? For actively dealing with the disease and how it's progressing and the loss and grief that you feel.
Yeah, well, Tracy, you mentioned it earlier. I think whatever Parkinson's is, it's a disease of loss, I'm convinced. I mean, I think it's also a disease of gain, but we lose a lot of things over time, right? That many of us, myself included, probably take for granted or took for granted, right? And so, I mean, this is in some ways, like my research is in this area. I mean, I've written books on, you know, bereavement. And so I know a little bit about this, both personally and kind of intellectually. But I really think naming that reality that, you know, we're going to lose things with Parkinson's, right? Physically, maybe, you know, with respect to our dreams, with our capacities to do things that are valuable to us. Our identity sometimes can come into question. Who are we now? How we're seen by others who may not know us, but make judgment. There's all kinds of losses that accumulate. And the residue from those losses, as it accumulates, can get more and more painful, right? So I really think, you know, finding people with whom we can share our experiences, who can help us name them, and to mourn, you know, if grieving is sort of what, you know, happens to you in the wake of a loss, mourning is what you do actively to try to get through that loss. And that's sort of the way I organize it. And there are some things we can do that help us through our own agency and the support of others navigate, you know, kind of rebuilding our lives or seeing the world anew by virtue of what we've lost. And, you know, all of us lose, whether it's Parkinson's or any other thing that we're dealing with, like, you know, to live is to lose in some ways. But it's not only to lose, right? And there are ways that you can find help through your experiences of loss, in my opinion, that can be life-giving.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think somebody's following up too with this, another really important point for people with Parkinson's. I mean, we have to honor our grief and we have to honor, you know, the time that we need to mourn what we've lost, but also some of what we lose in the process is just, you know, our partners. and their capacity, and we feel lonely. And somebody's asking about that, and I think that's really important, because your person can't go out as much as they once did, or aren't as verbal as they once were, and it's challenging. How do we manage that?
Well, I think for caregivers, it's, you know, loss is very significant too. Not only the patient, but the caregiver really needs people around them, needs to be able to express their feelings and grieve. It's real.
And for us, I think grieving together, right? I mean, we're each losing some things that are different, but we're losing a lot that we share in common, right? And that will continue over time. And I think, as someone who knows a little something about grief, I think it's good to grieve, you know, in this situation with your partner as well as without, if you will. I mean, I'm going to overstate to make the point, grieve on your own, but also to grieve together, right? I mean, because both are important. Or have outlets, or you know, not necessarily limited to one another, but have other outlets for your grief. But you know, we talk about things that, you know, we anticipate. There's anticipatory loss too, right? It's not just what you're losing, but what you anticipate losing. And sometimes that can be as painful as any loss that you experience. Yeah. It's important to recognize that too.
Yeah, it is. I think that's a good point too. And we've talked about that here as well. And it's really fair to hate the disease. It's really fair. And I think it's important to acknowledge and say that. And I like the fact that you talk about that together. And when I used to talk in front of big groups, you know, at some of our events, I get everybody to say, I hate Parkinson's disease together, because it made us feel better. You know, we don't hate our person with Parkinson's, we hate the disease. Yeah. But sometimes you conflate the two because you're angry. And it's important to keep that separate as well. And I think what you're saying, what you're advocating for, is this conversation. And it's a lifelong conversation, because guess what? There's no cure for Parkinson's. So when your person is diagnosed, it is a lifelong conversation that you need to have with each other to kind of endure, and but also to accept the good days, because guess what? Parkinson's isn't always bad. You don't always have bad days, right? You have good days too. And sometimes it's hard to get to those and really acknowledge those, but let's acknowledge those and spend some time, you know, just really reveling in them as well. I mean, every once in a while, when Davis has a great belly laugh, or, you know, has a good joke, or can march up the stairs without listing backwards. Yes, you know. We celebrate a lot. So I think it's important to acknowledge that too. And maybe that goes in the notebook, Gail. Maybe that's part of what we write down, when we write down that stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this time has gone way too fast. You guys have been great. Thank you.
We'll come back.
Come back. Yeah, it would be great. And I want to put the pdwise.com up there again. Make sure you know where to find Alan's writings and musings and music and a little bit of Tracy too, I think, is on there, and you know, just to really you know, dive in and learn from others, because I think that's what we're all about here anyway. You know, that's why we're here and why we're sharing. Gail,
yeah. I have something on my desk that you might close with, about caregivers and taking care of themselves, and how hard we try to make things the best and move things in the direction we know it should go. It says, don't sacrifice yourself to be a perfect caregiver. You can never really reach perfection. And this disease is ever changing. Be kind to yourselves. Easy to say, hard to do. Your inner voice judges you by overly harsh standards. So we just have to keep on pushing and find the humor in some strange way, laughing at absurdity. And that's we can't be perfect. We can just try like all of you are doing, because you're on this call and you're trying to find new ways to look at things.
Yeah. Thank you. And I will write that up in the newsletter. So we'll have it. You guys can refer back to it. And you know what? Thanks for showing up today, everybody, because that's what it's all about. You made it. You came, you shared, and we appreciate everyone for being here, and especially to our special guests, Alan and Tracy Cole. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
you for all you do, you and Davis and Polly and Sarah, everybody. We really appreciate the work that you do and benefit from it. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you too. Thank you.